the power boulders can be V14 or V15 and they'll get done. Time away from climbing and like not being able to exercise for long bouts, I like started to realize that I like have some kind of depression and anxiety, and that I've just been like self-medicating for the last 20 some years via climbing and exercise. They're just like a waste of plastic, and every time I see them, I'm just like, I can't believe you're just anyone's allowed to make a climbing hold company.
Welcome to another episode of the That's Not Real Climbing podcast. I'm your host, Jenny, and I'm excited to introduce my guest for today, Ben Hanna. Ben is a climber on Team USA and hold shaper for Pusher Holds. In this episode, we'll get some insight into the grades of World Cup boulders, how depression, anxiety, and ADHD shapes his relationship with climbing, how he balances working as a route setter with training, and we'll get his thoughts on hold shipping. I hope you enjoy this interview with Ben. I'm excited to announce that my sponsor, Mad Rock Climbing, just came out with a brand new pair of shoes, the Remora Pro. I was so excited to try them on that even though I broke a toe on my right foot, I had to at least try on the left shoe, so I can definitely say that the Remora Pro is better than a rental shoe. But really, these are their softest shoe ever, which means you no longer need to worry about standing on sketchy volumes and comps. They also have a crazy 3D heel that allows you to get more surface area when heel hooking, and inserts that lock your heel into the shoe no matter how hard you're pulling. Feel free to message me if you have any questions about the shoes or sizing, and you can use the discount code NOTREALCLIMBER for 10% off your entire Mad Rock order. Back to the show.
Yeah, I don't know how people do it. I hate climbing in the morning.
Yeah, I've been recently really like the last 2 years has been recently like been really enjoying early morning sessions. It's the afternoon sessions that I feel like I like perform not as well in.
But don't you feel like more stiff in the morning? Like at the end of the day is when you're like the most loose and stretched out and everything?
Honestly, I just feel really tired by the end of the day. Like 2 p.m. session comes around and I'm just like, man, I'm up for like 6 hours. Like I like have to like plan 2 meals for before the comp instead of just like cramming whatever I can in my face before I go. I'm also like, for me, the morning sessions are nice because I like will wake up and it's early, but I'll just like wake up and I'm like, okay, it's go time. I don't have to think about this all day about like, it's like, I think it's a lot about that too. You just like less to think about and like less stress because you just like wake up and it sucks because it's early and you go and then it's time to climb. It's like over with a lot faster.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, do you tend to feel like you're someone who gets super nervous before comps? Like it's on your mind all day?
I wouldn't say that I'm like a nervous wreck. Like I have some friends that are like nervous wrecks, but I definitely do get nervous and like have anxiety around it. In Korea, it was like really weird to deal with that because it felt like it was eight days. It was only 4 days, but like 4 proper rest days, and then I climbed on the 5th day, so I had like 5 days to think about the next round and like went through the whole range of emotions of like super stressed I wasn't gonna make the round, super psyched I made the round, like excited for the round, nervous for the round, kind of ready for the round to be over because I'd been in Korea for so long and I like didn't really get to do anything because I'm just like resting the whole time. I was like, I'm ready to get out of here. I was like, this bed sucks and like I haven't done anything all week. I just like do this thing and get over with it. Ready to go home.
Well, I mean, first of all, congrats on making it into semis for Korea at the World Champs. That was cool to see.
Thank you.
And so, yeah, like in that in-between time, you didn't really get to do any like fun things or traveling. You were just kind of resting.
Yeah, I was pretty locked in. We had like 2 days where we like bopped around a little bit. But I didn't do a bunch of sightseeing and I like tried to minimize my like going out and doing stuff. I also like went and watched every round. And so that ended up taking a bunch of time too. Usually I'll like won't go to all the rounds to like chill out before the comp, but I was like, I've got so many days, and I was also like psyched to watch climbing. So I just went and watched, like, I think every single round but one, which happened to be the women's final, which sucked because it was, like, the best round of the whole competition. And I was, like, so bummed because I wanted to watch Melina climb so badly.
Right.
But also I was, like, it's, like, 8 or 9. I think it started at, like, 8 the night before semis. I was, like, dude, I have to go get ready for bed, like. And it was like a long walk from the venue too. And I was like, I just can't be dealing with this. Like, I'm going to bed.
How did your rounds go? You felt like, how did the climbing feel?
They were okay. Weirdly enough, both China qualifiers and Korea semifinals, I felt like I had a mediocre round. Neither round I was like, oh, I'm on fire. It was like, oh, I'm like just barely doing enough. And then honestly, in Korea, I got to the last boulder and I tried it once. And at that point, I had like topped one boulder and I'd zoned everything really quickly. And I was almost positive that if I topped this boulder, I would be in semis. I was like, this feels like it would be enough to be into semis. And then I tried it and I fell going to the finish. On my first attempt and was like, okay, for sure this boulder is doable. And that means that like I probably need to do it to make the round. And I had like I would have like bet good money. I was like, I'm almost 100% sure that if I do this boulder, I make the semi. If I don't do this boulder, I don't make the semi. And then I watched the dude next to me in group B do the boulder. And I was like, okay, there's like confirmation bias that this boulder goes and is like probably necessary. And then I proceeded to just like totally fold under the pressure and not do the boulder. And I was like heartbroken. I knew I could do it. I was sure that I needed to do it. And I was like, this is my moment. Like I can achieve my goals if I just do this boulder, which I like will anyone. Anytime I talk about it, that's like the number one thing not to do is think about the goal and the end result and just focus in on how to do the boulder. But I like fully folded under the pressure, got wrapped up in all of the like, you know, if I do it results shenanigans. And I was so mad at myself. I was like, so mad at myself. The season was over and I like was really bummed. And then I got out of ISO and everyone was like, dude, you did it. You're in, and I was like, I don't believe you. And then I was in 21st at that moment. And so I was like, they're like, oh yeah, like there's no way that the next 20 something dude, someone doesn't knock me out. And somehow I like held on for the rest of the round and ended up getting like the last spot in. But it was like, I was really, really upset with myself because I felt like I really didn't do my best. I like didn't have my best day. And it wasn't just like a physical thing. It was a mental thing where like I should have done that boulder. I know I could have done that boulder. And I like folded under the pressure. And it was like more frustrating and upsetting than it ended up being like happy about making the semi, because I was mostly just focused on how like I folded under the pressure and didn't do the thing that I knew I needed to do. And then the round in semifinals, I honestly was much happier with. The result kind of sucked. I'm like really not happy with that result. The first boulder was one of the boulders I like had a shot of topping and felt like that one was doable. But it was really just like about finding the right body position to like jump. And I didn't find it. And I was like, okay with that. I was like, it would have been nice to have done that boulder, and I probably could have done that boulder and like in a different day maybe did do that boulder, but it felt like it was just kind of it's a skill issue, but it also felt like kind of a luck issue. Like sometimes you find the right position and sometimes you just don't. And under 4 minutes, you get like, you know, a couple of tries. It's like that day I didn't find it, and that's okay. And then the second boulder was a lot more straightforward, and I really should have done that boulder. It felt really hard, the last move. And then I proceeded to watch everyone else just own the move. And Colin even told me that boulder was like, he was like, that's like a white FBP. Literally no one, like no, like anyone, everyone should do that boulder. That boulder's like so easy. It's like too easy for a brown. If it lived over,
after
like,
knowing
Ben,
that you didn't do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We were like at dinner after the round, and he was like, "Sorry, Ben, that boulder was so easy. It was just like literally you couldn't not do that boulder." I was like, "Yeah, fair enough." Also, how'd that zone go on number five? So yeah, probably should have done that one. That was the one I like wish I had done, but it wasn't like I dropped the top or like mentally fumbled. It was just like the move felt hard and I didn't do it, and that's okay. And then four or three like felt hard and I didn't do it, and that was okay. I think I got two tops or three tops. It's like, for me, I'm not that motivated or distressed when I don't do the power block that only two dudes do. That's like feels fine to me. I'm not upset about that. And then five, I was a little bummed about, because that was also a boulder that I probably should have done, like arguably in a different day.
Wait, you mean
number four? Number four, yeah, the slab. In like a different day, I flashed that boulder, I think, and it ended up taking me like all 4 minutes to find, or 5 minutes to find, just the zone. And then when I found the zone, I was like, oh, that was like really easy. It was super chill to get there once I figured out the way. And that felt like I was getting flustered and like just bad decision making. And so that was like kind of a bummer. And two was kind of a bummer. And then the result overall was kind of a bummer. I was like, kind of thought that maybe four zones was going to be better than second to last place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I guess it was a high scoring round.
Yeah, it was a super high scoring round. It was like weird because two of the boulders like didn't go for a lot of people. But then a lot of people like last second squeaked out some of the boulders. Like Colin said, number two was piss easy. And so everyone did it. And so
I wouldn't say a white at BP is necessarily easy. And for reference, white at BP is V8 to V10.
It's funny too, because I was like, there's no way it's a white. Like, I set the whites at BP, and like, we have probably the stiffest BP in the country. And under Greg would never let me get away with calling that a white boulder. Never let me get away with calling that a white boulder. Maybe bottom mint, but still, I mean, but then on that caliber, like, bottom mint's supposed to be V11, and V11 as a power boulder in World Cup is like crazy. I think we talked about this last time, like logistically the power boulders can be V14 or V15 and they'll get done.
In a World Cup format.
In a World Cup format, yeah. Like in a semifinal, they'll get tops. There was one in China that was, Colin said, was like impossible, and then it got two tops. He was like, it was 8B from the zone to the top.
But you don't feel like you're a power boulder?
No, I mean, I'm like, I have done hard things and can do hard things, but I definitely would not consider myself like in the strong end of the field.
Would you say like that the power boulders in World Cups are maybe like harder in difficulty compared to like cordo moves or slab?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, just like because of the like what they're asking. Like if you make a V13 or V14 cordo move, and it's asking like risk, and it's also asking like body position, like the boulder one in semis, which was the cordo boulder, was risky, but really what it was asking was like finding the right trajectory of that. And so like find that was difficult enough on its own, that the like physicality of the boulder didn't have to be that hard. And if it was that hard, then you would have significantly lower tops, if no tops on that move. There's definitely less cordo in qualifiers, so I can like speak less to how difficult they actually are. But just like as someone who sets and like has set comps and like has my hand in that kind of field, like you really don't have to make as any other attributes that make a boulder difficult go up, then you can lower the intensity of the boulder. Versus like a straightforward power boulder, you can make it V15 if there's like an easily readable sequence and like down pulling holds, then the majority of those dudes are so strong. Like they will go out climbing once a year and just like dookie on every double digit pull they're in an area. Like Adam Shahar went to Switzerland after Prague last year, or so I think it was Prague, and he had like a 100-digit day or 100 V-point day where he climbed like 2 V14s, 3 V13s, and like 4 V12s all in a day, which is crazy to me because like if I climb a V14, I'm psyched.
Right. Yeah.
Like I climbed a V13 yesterday, and I was like geeked out of my mind.
Congrats.
Like it took me 20 sessions.
Oh, geez. Well, congrats on finally getting it. So I guess like logistically, if there is such a hard power boulder in like a World Cup semis or finals, and you only have 4 minutes, that's not a lot of time if you like mess up the first time to rest enough and do it again.
Totally.
Do you feel like that kind of makes it an issue in terms of like watchability interest? Because like you can't, I don't know, it only like your tries only get worse from there, right? If you only have 4 minutes.
Totally. I personally don't think so. I like really enjoy watching the straightforward power boulders. Like at this point, for me, watching climbing competitions, I enjoy the like when they give us like straightforward-ish, but like what people would call traditional rock climbing power blocks. Like men's four in the final was a good example of that. It wasn't my favorite boulder, but there was like a little bit of complexity and risk. But like it boiled down to a really bad crimp and a really bad sloper. And I think everyone climbed it wrong. I think you're supposed to do like some flip, but like that was pretty close to a rock climb. And it was by far the most fun boulder to watch for me. Obviously, part of it's like it's the fourth boulder, so everything comes down to it, and it's like all boils down to the last boulder. But that was like the most out of all the climbs, that was the most enjoyable one. And that was honestly the one that I like stopped talking to my friends and was like, oh, I'm psyched to watch this. This is sick. The other thing too is like, I mean, maybe people spend more time on the pads when there's like a hard boulder, but in a 4 minute round for a final, like you'll give it a go and you'll either do it or you won't. And then you'll rest for like the minute and then you get to, and then you'll give it a go again. And then that will be the end of the round. And so maybe it ends up having slower rounds, but I think for anyone that like enjoys rock climbing and enjoys watching comps, I think it might be just as exciting. I don't know. I would advocate for it to be just as exciting.
Yeah, I think it depends. I think for me, sometimes it's sad to watch, like, if they just, like, get shut down and then that's all you see. That's also kind of sad to see. So it depends. But then it is nice to, like, see later rounds where people, like, actually show that it's doable and it looks like
a totally different
boulder. But, yeah, I could see an argument for both ways. Okay, so kind of a long intro, I guess. But for those who don't know your background, let's get into back to the beginning where how you got into climbing and competing.
Okay, yeah. So I started climbing with my dad when I was like 2 or 3. He would just bring me outside climbing with him on the weekends. That was like our thing. It was like either skiing or climbing. And then when I was 10, I really enjoyed skiing. I didn't really like climbing that much. And then when I was 10, I switched schools and we had a climbing wall at the school. And I was like telling everyone how awesome I was at climbing. And one of the kids was like, oh, you're not that good. There's this kid, Quincy, and he got second at nationals last year. And at that point, I didn't know there was like climbing comps or nationals or I really didn't know anything. And I was like, whoa, okay. And I just like, my competitive spirit was like, I need to do that then, because obviously this kid's better than me and I need to be better than him. So I like joined the climbing team with Quincy and we quickly became best friends. And then I like started doing comps and fell in love with doing comps. And then within like a couple of weeks of joining the climbing team was like, Dad, I'm going to be a professional rock climber. And my parents, super supportive, were like, okay, cool. Like, if you change your mind, let us know, but we'll support you as long as you want to do that. And now I'm 26, almost 27, and I'm still doing it.
You had a rock climbing like wall in your school?
Yeah.
Well, that's like pretty rare to find. I actually, in my middle school, we also had a rock climbing wall, which was super strange thinking back on it, because like nobody has a rock climbing wall in school.
No, totally. I think my dad actually built it. And he's like, he's a super, super talented. I'm trying to think of the right word. He's really good at building things and doing things. And this is kind of a tangent, but and maybe a great, it's kind of a tangent, but he was always building stuff for me and my sister and like the school and stuff. And my mom always building crazy like gates and stuff. And decks and all kind of everything, all the things. Yeah, it was like super alternative school. This kind of ties back into it. I was super ADHD as a kid, still am. And so my parents quickly realized that, like, also super dyslexic. So like the first school I went, basically my parents were like, we're putting him in private school. And so like, he doesn't just get left behind, because if he goes to public school, like he will never learn to read and he'll like never get anywhere in life, because I was just always bouncing off the walls and like couldn't read. And so like, they put me in this super alternative school called Little Earth. And it was like this massive, they had this huge, playground, and the school was like structured around a lot of like outdoor playtime. And then even in that situation, I had to be like, have special needs. Like the teachers would like pull me aside and be like, okay, go run 3 laps around the playground because you're distracting all the kids and you obviously need to like move for a bit. It was pretty funny. But yeah, my dad ended up building the climbing wall for it. And I think that was like, they built the climbing wall, and then I immediately was like, okay, I'm really gonna climb.
Okay, and since you went into it a little bit, you mentioned before you kind of recently felt like you used climbing as like self-medication for ADHD. What does that kind of look like for you?
Growing up, and I guess the best way to tell a story is like, as far as that goes, is last year I like went back home and my dad and me went climbing, and like on the road trip or drive to the crag, he was like, hey, we have this hard conversation. It's like, oh God, okay. He's like, recently me and my mom found out that we probably have ADHD. I was like, yeah, I know. We also kind of think that you possibly have it. And I was like, Dad, we know. Like, that's why I went to all those special schools as a kid, is because I couldn't sit still all day. Like, they had to like, you had to pay someone a bunch of money to like make sure I like would learn anything. I always knew I had ADHD, and it's like always been a part of my life, and we just kind of decided not to medicate for it. I kind of, and that was like the confining part of that conversation, was they were like, we think you have ADHD. We knew this. I thought we just decided as a family we weren't going to put me on medication. He was like, no. Which I thought was hilarious, because I've always known. And I was just like, my parents won't put me on medication. But yeah, it does sound nice, because I would love to be able to do what you guys do, which is sit down and write. But then the other, like, I think more applicable to like what I've learned about my climbing is, I also have other family members that like have struggled with like depression, anxiety, and I always thought that was kind of like their thing and I was fine. And then after like taking time away from climbing and like not being able to exercise for long bouts, I like started to realize that I like probably also have some kind of, you know, depression and anxiety, and that I've just been like self-medicating for the last 20 some years via climbing and exercise, using the dopamine from exercising to like counterbalance the lack of dopamine that my brain produces.
Yeah, makes sense.
Which, like, I think has structured and created a lot of the routines that I've created around climbing, which would include, like, going to the gym at 9 o'clock at night after a long day of work, and, like, just absurd amounts of, like, just absurd things that I, like, also recently realized because me and my girlfriend moved in together. And so we're like planning and scheduling around each other. She's like, "You're crazy. Like, why are you doing this?" And I was like, "I don't know. It's just how I live my life." And it's like, because I need to get outside every day and do something like multiple times a day to like get to that dopamine.
I guess, does it kind of feel like you're like one reliable source of joy in life?
For sure. I wouldn't say it's my like only source of joy in life, but I will like find myself sinking into like, you know, bits of like anxiety or depression and then realize that like I just need to go do something outside or like go to the gym and exercise, and then I feel significantly better. Why that is, I don't know. I haven't like been tested or gone to, like, I just have been kind of making correlations between how I feel and what I do. And I'm like, okay, like I do have weird gym routines, and I also feel really bad when I don't do things outside or exercise. And I'm sure everyone is like, yeah, I feel bad when I don't do things like go outside. But it's like, I think to another level of like it really started to hate my life. I'm like, oh, it's because I didn't go out. I didn't exercise today. I need to go to the gym.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
Which could be a bad thing, but also I feel like it's partially part of my success in climbing is the fact that like I'm just constantly going to the gym. Sometimes it's really useless time in the gym. It's like not beneficial time in the gym.
Like non-effective, really.
Yeah, like there's definitely an effective way to get everything done and be an athlete, you know, be an athlete. And then there's like, I have to go to the gym 3 days a week. Or not 3 days a week, 3 times a day. And I mill around for a long time. And I'm just like doing random things that are like are not that, but it's just like, I need to go to do something to feel good.
Well, yeah. Thank you for sharing that. First of all, I think that there's probably a lot of people who can relate to that and experience something similar. Do you like have plans to get medicated, you think, or does this work out all right for you?
I don't have any plans in getting medicated. I think about it often. I don't have really any interest in medicating for like depression or anxiety. Although like sometimes I'm like, this sucks. It's pretty manageable. And I've been self-medicating for so long. And at no point am I ever like the super depressive dude who walks around, you know, like it's never gotten so bad that I'm like, oh, I need to get medicated because it's super bad. It's mostly just like, I started to notice it and was like, oh, that probably explains my behaviors. I've thought about ADHD on and off, and it could be really nice to get medicated for that. It just sounds like a lot of work. And also I'm not like really sure if the benefits outweigh the cons, and maybe there are no cons. I don't know. It's just been something I've been like programmed to not like. I'm like kind of scared of medicating for that. And I'm like, well, I'm doing fine so far. So like, do I really need to like mess with it? Or
yeah, I guess.
Do I just like, I've kind of structured my life around not needing to do the things that I struggle with. And like, I think we talked about this last time, was like a couple times a year, it really sucks because I like, you know, can't sit down and write. So like, taxes, those suck. Those are like the bane of my existence, because like the act of like sitting down and typing is like really difficult for me, and like focusing long enough to like do something I'm not interested in doing, taxes, really hard. So like currently I still haven't filed last year's taxes. I filed like an extension, but like, yeah, like it's bad, but it's like one time a year I need to just like do the thing that sucks really bad. But then the rest of my life, like, I don't really need, I've like gone out of my way to structure my life in such a way that I like don't need to do things I have a hard time doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think there might be some con? I mean, I don't really know what the cons are. I mean, now I'm just speculating because I'm not a doctor, but you should probably ask a doctor.
You probably should. That's one of the things I'm really bad at is like scheduling doctor's appointments. So that's probably why I haven't done it yet.
And also, I guess, just want to put a disclaimer that by self-medicating, you just mean like through climbing and not just like taking random medications by yourself.
No, just climbing, just excessive amounts of exercise.
Yeah. So I guess with your self-medicating for ADHD and climbing, what does your training schedule end up looking like? Or is it really just like you kind of go with the flow? If you're interested in ad-free episodes and would like to unlock over 4 hours of deleted scenes, including one where Ben gives his thoughts on USA team selection process, do consider helping support this podcast on Patreon. Some other perks include a membership pin shipped to you after 2 months, prioritized guest questions, or the ability to submit video questions, and more to come. The proceeds go back into the podcast to help me break even, and they help me improve the experience of the guests. If you'd like to help out non-monetarily, liking, commenting, and sharing helps a great deal as well. Back to the show.
This probably also a byproduct of the ADHD is I just really go by the flow. So it could be more structured. I've had structured plans. Right now, I don't like have a coach that writes me a training plan. So I don't have like a structured plan. The other thing that's changed recently is like last January, I started working full time as a route setter and as front desk of the gym. And it is like very time consuming. And so I've had to cut back probably like 60 to 70% of my training.
Oh, geez.
Which, yeah, is a lot. I like have been in this constant state of like, I'm getting good results, but I'm also in like constant anxiety that I'm not training enough for the last year, which is kind of a bummer. Because I'm just like, yeah, in a constant state of like, I really should have trained today and I should have trained yesterday and I'm always tired and this sucks and like, I'm not doing enough and I'm like, yeah, I'm not doing enough. But also, I'm in the best shape of my life and I'm getting good results. So part of me still like fires right back with like, well, how good could it be if you were training enough? So I don't know. But right now it's not a lot. I set 2 days a week. So those are like two of my climbing days. And then I climb when I can. Between like most of it's schedule and another part of it's just like dealing with being tired. Like I can't climb after I work. I just like don't have enough energy after, so the sessions are just like worthless. So I might as well just rest and then wait for a day that I have energy to climb. So that's mostly what I mean by like I climb when I can, because it's like the days that I have energy to climb, I climb and train, and then the days that I don't, I just rest.
So like how many climbing days would you say a week?
So last week I did the comp Saturday, Sunday. No. All day Saturday. And then I rested Sunday. And then I set Monday, Tuesday, Thursday. And then I tried to climb Thursday night and it was bad.
Yeah.
And then I rested Friday, Saturday. And then I climbed yesterday. And then I tried to do a session today and I was wrecked. So it was like pretty bad. I went in and like warmed up essentially. And then was like, it's just not worth my time. And went home. And then I'll set tomorrow and Thursday. And then compete Friday, Saturday.
I mean, so you count like setting days as climbing days? Because like setting is a totally different exhaustion to like training.
Yeah, exactly. I have started to count them as climbing days only because if I don't, my climbing days look really bad. So it's like, and also I'm still in good shape and like still getting stronger. So I assume that part of it's from setting. It's not optimized, but like they do still count as climbing days to me. Unless they're like, if we do like a slab day, where we like super low level stuff, but even then I'm still like it's I might as well just go to the TC and like do, it'd be the same as going to the TC and doing like a no hands day. We also implemented a mint circuit. And so quite frequently I'll like set a mint boulder, which is like between V11 and B15, and then like four on it all day. So that's like counts as to me as max bouldering.
Wow. Well, it's kind of crazy to hear that you really don't get like that many training specific days. I feel like maybe back in the day, it sounded like people were more lax about like their climbing competitions and training for it. But nowadays, I hear a lot of more athletes saying that they're doing like 5 days a week, like all day in the gym with like specific boulder set for them and things like that. So it's kind of crazy to hear that you kind of have this wild schedule and still manage to even make it into like semis. So
yeah,
kind of crazy to hear.
Yeah, I don't know why it's working for me. And to like throw another curveball at you, my climbing up until team trials was I did 6 weeks at Jumbo Love, climbing only on that route every other day. And then I took 5 days off, and then I went to Spain and climbed like 2 days on, 1 day off, or 1 day on, 1 day off for a month just in Spain on a rope. And then I took 8 days off. And then the month leading up to team trials, I only set during the week, Monday, Tuesday.
Jeez.
And then I would drive out to the Hurricane and climb Friday, Saturday, or Saturday, Sunday, both days, and then come home and do just setting. And that was like the only training I did leading up to team trials. And then the last 2 weeks before team trials, I took a break on my lunch break from setting and ran across the street. And like, I finished setting at 11, ran across the street, pulled on the hangboard, and then did a mock round, and then would run straight back and finish setting, because I had like an hour long break. And that was like the only TC sessions and like climbing training that I did leading up to team trials. And that was like, that was it. That was all I did. So I have no idea I have all of my ideas about training have gone out the window. Cause like before that,
what the heck?
I did like 4 years of like pretty much no work, just TC. And that was like all I did was I just trained at the TC like 3 to 4 or 5 days a week for like years and was getting mediocre results. And then I stopped doing that, started climbing outside and setting.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that those years still like paid off in a way.
For sure.
Yeah. It still helps you have that like baseline for sure. But yeah, wow, that is crazy to hear. And it does still make me wonder like how much better you would be if you had like the same crazy training routine as a lot of people do.
Yeah. I try not to think about that because currently I really need my job.
Yeah, so, unfortunately, money is an important part.
Unless someone listening has another solution. Yeah, I need a job.
Yeah, unfortunately, life moves on and we all need a job to live as well.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So going into a bit more about like World Cups and USA climbing as well, I heard in another interview that you actually prefer lead climbing, but you have only been doing bouldering. So what happened there?
Yeah, that's a funny one. So for a couple of years, I trained almost exclusively lead. I would still boulder, but I like focused most of my effort on like competition lead climbing, and like year after year, I would show up to nationals and team trials like in the best shape of my life, and then not make the team, and then make the team in bouldering, and be like, I guess we're doing another year of bouldering, and then train all year for lead, and then show up and bomb lead nationals and team trials and make the lead team. Like even this year, like I said, all of my training up till team trials was climbing outside on a rope. Like I climbed outside on a rope for 3 or 4 months. That was like all I did. And I was in really good shape. I think I was on like fourth or third place on A-Day in America as far as like the like ranking. I was like in really good shape. I had climbed a bunch of hard routes. I was super fit and super ready for lead team trials. And I got like 24th. And I was like, cool, that was team trials. And then I won net bouldering, which happened to be the only result that would have put me on the team. And so then I did Bouldering World Cups again.
So yeah, what do you think it was that makes you, I don't know, like, what's the word? Can't think of a nice way to say it.
I like, see there's not a nice way to say it.
How to stop choking on lead climbs.
Yeah, I don't know. I would love to figure that out because I think I could be quite good at lead World Cups if I could figure it out. But that's exactly what it is. It's just like straight choking on in the round. I think the thing that I don't know how to like mentally change it, but the two things that I think play into it are, as far as bouldering goes, even in a World Cup, I don't feel like I have to do the really hard power boulder. Like, you didn't have to do boulder. Like, yeah, it's just you never have to do the power boulder unless you want to win world championships. That was the only comp I can think of in this year. Someone will correct me if I'm wrong, that you had to do the power boulder if you wanted to, like, you needed to win. But like, as far as my goals go, like, I don't need to do the B14. And my strong suit is like figuring out things fast and being like good at easier boulders. So as far as like World Cups go, or like, you know, competition rounds go, like, the boulders, unless you're in the power boulder, aren't that difficult. Like, they're in my physical capability of doing them like within 4 minutes. And so I think I excel at doing what I can do fast. And that's why I like do well in bouldering rounds. In lead climbing, I think I do not excel at like flash attempts. Like, I don't think that's my, I'm really good at like projecting. And I really enjoy climbing really hard things and like trying hard things for a long time and figuring out and being really fit and doing like, yeah, really hard things. But in like lead competitions, it's like only one try. And so it's like all just about flashing. And then the other thing that I think plays into it is the style of lead climbing, which is funny enough. I think you have to be like really strong to be a lead climber, because it's just more straightforward. And so like for lead climbing, it's like in competition, they're like power enduro routes. They're short power enduro routes. And so you just have to be able to climb like 8C plus or 9A like power routes first try, which just means it's like Yannick excels in lead climbing. Because he's just one of the strongest dudes, period. And so like all he needs is a little bit of fitness and he can just like power through these lead routes. And he'll argue about that for sure. I'm sure that he has like, he's like, no, I'm in lead shape, I've been lead climbing. But I'm like, no, dude, like you're just stupidly strong. And so like the moves are just easier for you. Hmm. Where for me, I don't know, I just like short power enduro routes are not my like go-to route. So I think it has a stack of things. It's like A, short power enduro routes, not my thing. B, first try, also not my thing. C, I get stressed and choke.
Yeah, so I guess it's interesting that I guess you don't really like consider yourself like a strong climber.
I mean, it depends on who I'm comparing myself against. Because
sure,
like there's some groups that I feel super strong in, but like as far as like the overall world, over comparing myself to like the best of the best, I don't think that I'm like, you know, like I'm not climbing V17 right now. I don't know. Maybe I'm strong, but like, and honestly, this year too, I feel a lot stronger than I have in the past. Like now I'm like, oh, I can do like the harder moves on the circuit given the right circumstance. But
so I guess I mean like you don't consider yourself better at learning movement compared to just like brute force strength kind of boulders.
Yeah.
So I guess I find that maybe not like surprising, but I'm kind of wondering like how that plays into you also thinking that you prefer seeing more old school power boulders in terms of like setting.
Yeah, it's a funny conundrum because it's not what I like will excel at, but I just really enjoy watching it.
Okay.
I just like really enjoy watching it. Climbing on it generally is a little bit less fun for me because like the straightforward rock climbing boulders we've had this year, I haven't been able to start. Like we had one in Innsbruck and I like couldn't start the boulder. But it was sick. I was like geeking on the mat. Like, this is so sick, dude. It's like a drive by to a 20 mil crib. This is so tight. But yeah, no, I just like, I mean, I don't know. I've watched a lot of World Cups. I've been to a lot of comps. I've seen the sport like change and grow and go through all these different iterations. And so like, it's not in my best interest, but I like just think that it's way cooler. And I'm not saying I don't like where the sport is now. I think that there's like some really cool movement going on and some really cool, like a lot of it's technology, like Dual-Tex and thermal molded holds, like different forms of fiberglass, really cool stuff. But I think that it's like overwhelmingly in one direction, and I would love to see some diversity in the climbing comp, because like what made those jumps so sick is how different it was from like what we were used to seeing. And it like, I mean, I watched the sport change over the last 20 years. Like I remember like when run jumps were like the thing, and it was like so sick and like, dude, you can grab a jug and you can run across a bunch of volumes and this is so sick. And then they were like, well, what if instead of going from a jug and then running across a bunch of volumes and grabbing a jug, the hold was directional. So you had to like run across a bunch of volumes and then grab a directional hold and then do some like weird thing with your hand where you had to grab like three holds, or it was like two holds. And then it was like, well, what if we go four holds and then five holds? And then what if we go like three holds this way, but you can't stop, so you have to go back to the right? And like, it was sick. I like watched it happen and it's been really cool to watch and I love climbing on it. But I feel like we're doing so much of that, that there's like the other stuff has gotten left out. Like the example I gave was like just jumping to a pinch, just like square climbing on pinches. Like there was a boulder at ABS Nationals 15 or 16 that Daniel won on. And it was like the orange Technic pinches. I think they're like the fatty, tall, long pinches. And I was like, I would just give anything to see another one of those boulders on the wall. Just once. Just like, you know, one boulder in the season where it was just like, grab pinch, jump to pinch, drive by to pinch. Or like, more crimping. I think that would be really cool. Like, to like, I mean, show how far we will like count how many crimps we climb on in the season. We're like, oh yeah, this World Cup, we grabbed a crimp. Dang. And I feel like that's kind of a bummer where you're like, you can count on one hand the amount of crimps you grabbed the whole competition. Like that feels like it's missing something. There's like a missing a little bit of diversity. And I like doing cordo moves and I like doing run across jumps and I like I love Dual-Tex. But I would also like to be challenged and like get the chance to see people climb on or get the opportunity to climb on like frontal crimp climbing.
Well, do you feel like this year they've been setting a little bit more like old school boulders maybe or like power?
It's been getting better. It's been getting better. I think the last podcast I went on was with Gnarly right before the season started. And I was like, my predictions are we see some more rock climbing.
Okay.
Because I think I was hoping the sport would turn back that way. And I didn't get to see as many as I wanted, but I saw more, which was really cool. Like China, semifinal, blue boulder, just straight crimp rig. There was one of the sickest boulders all season for me to climb. I don't know. I was like really psyched.
How was the separation on that one? I'm trying to remember. It was a long time ago.
Kachow, semifinal, men, boulder, three. It had one, two flashes. Whoa, maybe not the best separation. Two flashes, which is crazy. Three, so three tops, two flashes, 1 second attempt, and then a handful of zones, and then a bunch of no zones. And then boulder two had, that's actually super sick. Me, Mejdi, and Tomoa were the only people to flash the second boulder. That's wild.
Huh.
I thought that boulder was pissed. I was like, this boulder's too easy.
Okay. What kind of boulder was it? Do you remember?
It was like a dual tex press. And then you grabbed like a foot chip and jumped to, it was all squadra holds. And it was like dual tex press. You grabbed like a no shadow, technique no shadow, and you like jumps to another squadra. It's the good set of these.
Oh, okay.
And then you did like a Lachey double clutch. It was like two of those.
You remember that one being easy?
Yeah, I was like this. That was my chance to talk, to like look at Colin and be like, dude, literally pink at BP. Like you couldn't not do that boulder.
Yeah.
It's impossible to fall in that boulder. He said that to me twice this year.
Wow. Yeah. What's like the dynamic there in terms of competitiveness?
It's a great dynamic. I like that kid so much. I love that kid. I've been on the circuit with him for like 5 years now, which has been really cool because I remember when he was like 17 and just joined, like it was his first year on the circuit. And at the point I was like 21, and I was like, it was like weird because he was like young and he was like 17. And so it was kind of awkward because I was like, this kid's literally a kid. I was like not even 18 yet. And then like Seoul, after the round was over and like the comp was done, we were like, we can like get a drink together. We're like both over 21 and like adults and the comp's over, which was, I was like, oh, this is like cool. Like I remember when you were a kid and now we're just like both adults. And he's like such a sweet kid and like really thoughtful. And I don't know, yeah, I really like him. And he meets me at the same level of like banter. Like I'm kind of, I can like kind of poke a little hard. I'm like a little like, I like to banter, and he just like meets my banter at the same level and like will give me shit. And I like that because I don't know. I like people that give me shit.
What do you feel like are the differences between your climbing styles?
Well, he's just way better than me.
Okay.
He's really good at this like straight arm kind of climbing. Mm-hmm. Like he has probably the strongest three finger drag that I've ever seen in my life. And he's also exceptionally good at coordination. Like I think I'm pretty good at coordination and he's so much better at coordination than me. And he's also freakishly strong. Like I think Colin is one of the strongest dudes on the circuit. It doesn't always show, but like he really is freakishly strong. And when he's able to like channel that, I think like he's one of the strongest dudes on the circuit. And like boulders like that one in Kachow, like he didn't do. And he was like, it's too hard. It doesn't go. But I think he was grabbing the hold wrong. Like I watched him like take the hold as like a side pull instead of a down pull, or a down pull instead of a side pull. And then the two dudes that did it like grabbed it the right way. And it's like small things like that. But I think he's he's really, really strong. He's really good at coordination. And then the only difference, like not difference between us, but like one of the, I think the other differences is that I excel on slab, maybe less this year, but I do feel like I'm a good slab climber. And I think that's maybe his weakness. And so that was like the one thing I maybe have on him is like a little bit better slab climbing.
Okay. Moving on for now. I know throughout this interview, you've talked about like different holds that people use in the competitions and World Cups and local competitions as well. I think that makes sense because you do a lot of hold shaping yourself. How did you get into that?
So Quincy, the kid I talked about from my school, him and his dad used to make climbing holds. That's just kind of a fun thing. They had a home wall, and so they'd make climbing holds for their home wall. And we had a play date because we were 10, and that's what you do when you're 10.
Cute.
I miss play dates so bad.
Well, you can still do them.
Yeah, right? And I feel like we should start, you know, adult play dates. But yeah, I like went over to his house and we made climbing holds, and I was like, this is the sickest thing ever. And like, as I do, immediately fell in love with it and was like, I want to do this all the time. So that was how I got into it. And then I pretty much just annoyed everyone that would tolerate me to teach me how to make climbing holds. We started a hold company that never went anywhere. And then I started another hold company with another buddy, which went a little farther. We sold holds to like some friends for their home wall and then some to the climbing gym. And then I met Typhoos at Bouldering Nationals and just bugged him. And we ended up becoming really good friends, and he like taught me a bunch of stuff. And then I bugged Ian from Kilter for like, I would just message him online all of the time, just asking all of these stupid questions. And like, he let me come over and he let me shape. And then when I moved to Salt Lake City, I met Jared at Pusher and just like wouldn't leave him alone. It was just like constantly bugging him. And it was like, I think I went over there to climb with Nathaniel, and I just spent the whole time Nathaniel was climbing just talking to Jared about shapes. I like always had a fascination with Pusher. So I was just like geeked to be there and like meet Jared. I was like, it was like way cooler than meeting any of my like climbing idols. I was like so psyched. I like was geeked out of my mind and spent like 4 hours talking to him about climbing holds. And he's like, you can come over whenever you want. It's like, cool. So like the next day I like was like, hey, can I come over? Yeah. And like, and he like let me shape some holds for him, which we ended up making. And I just like kept coming over and shaping and bugging him and climbing and shaping and bugging him. And we like became good friends. And so eventually he like gave me a key because he was like, this doesn't make sense for me to be here all the time when you're here. Like, you keep texting me at like 10 o'clock at night if you could come shape. So like, here's a key. And so I was just like, go over there all of the time, at like crazy hours of the night and shape away. And we just like became really good friends, me and Jared and Kevin, and are like super tight now. I consider them both like some of my best friends. And yeah, we're like really good dudes.
Well, so like what makes a good hold for you?
Oof, that's a good question. I remember you asked me this last time when I didn't have a good answer. And I still don't have a good answer. I have a much better answer of what makes a bad hold.
Okay, go for that. Yeah, love to hear that too.
There are bad holds because they're inattention to detail and done sloppily. And then there are really good holds that are also have very little attention to detail and done really sloppily. But maybe it's the attention to detail. And I'm going to try not to call anyone out by name, but there are some really, really good hold companies would make fantastic revolutionary shapes, that are done in like the lowest quality ever. Like not the lowest quality, but they like it's really funny to see the attention to detail that just isn't there on like the small things. But the hold itself is absolutely amazing. And like some like is one of my favorite holds. And there's like a lot of them. But like a good example is dual techs. Like you can tell how much time someone spent and like the level of craftsmanship because of dual techs.
I don't know if I have any dual techs holds in my room right now. I don't have any good examples of this. But there's different ways to do a dual techs. And you can kind of tell on the hold how they did the dual techs. You can either do it on the foam before you mold it or after you mold it, and then you can remold it again. You can either do it by taking material away or adding material. And you can tell what material, like, at least I can tell how they did it. And like Jared is one of the most like meticulous craftsmen I've ever seen. His attention to detail is like insane and spectacular, which I think makes him a really, really good hold shaper. And you can tell from looking at his holds the like level of craftsmanship. Like I'll shape a hold and I'll be done with it and I'll be like, look at this hold that's ready to be molded. And he's like, it needs 2 more hours because you didn't do this and this, and there's a bump here, and it is, and like he's like, I'll think a hold's done and I'm ready to mold it. And he's just like, it's not even close to done. Like small things, like he once he's like drilled the holes where the like bolt is gonna go and the screw's gonna go, he'll go back in and round off the edges and clean it up so that when you like put your thumb in the hold, it's not a sharp or hard edge. It's like a rounded, like smooth edge, and we'll blend the dual techs into the bolt hole so that like when you put your thumb in the bolt hole, you don't slip out. You like, or you do slip out. Whereas like some people will like dual techs a hole, drill the hole, ship it off and mail it. And then it comes back and it's this dual techs hole that has this sharp in-cut edge where your thumb goes. Small things like that. Flat hold also, like I have so much infinite respect for them as well, because their attention to detail and craftsmanship is like also on that same level. And like they're what, when they release something, it's done really well and with a lot of thought and intention. And so like they make really good holds made really well. And I think that's like an idea versus like some other companies make really cool holds that are like really good shapes, but done really fast. And they're like, oh, just like put a thing of dual text there so you can't step on it.
Wow. So like with the bolt hole dual text thing, is that like done individually per hold that comes out?
No. That's all on the master.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And so you can do it like, you can do it, on the plastic, and then like basically you'd like you'd mold the hold, you'd dual tex it, and then you'd mold it again. Okay. Or you can do it like on the foam and then mold that, and they have different pros and cons. They look different, and you can tell when you like look at a hold closely whether it was like if the dual tex like blends into the plastic, you can tell it was done on the plastic, on like a plastic hold, versus like if there's a hard edge, you can tell that like that means that the dual text was like done on the foam and then molded. And then there's like a whole category of holds which I would consider bad holds. These are all good holds, is like these are all the things, like the differences in like hold companies that make really good holds. And then there's the companies that make bad holds that I like don't even know how to explain, but they're just like a waste of plastic. And every time I see them, I'm just like, I can't believe you're just, anyone's allowed to make a climbing hold company.
Yeah.
Like that's one of the questions I ask myself frequently. I'm like, I can't believe that someone decided that it was worth their money to mold this. And then someone
spent their money to buy it, which is crazy.
Is it like ergonomics or just like a shave that's already been done, or like what is it?
So that's really annoying. When someone does a hold that's already been done and doesn't do their own thing to it, that's annoying, especially when they don't do a good job. But most of it is like ergonomics or something I see a lot of, which I really don't like, is really poorly done rock texture holds. So like there's a lot of companies that make rock textured holds that don't actually look like rock texture and are kind of uncomfortable to grab because they have this like natural look to them, and like they're A, not artistic to look at, and B, they're like really unfun to grab. They're kind of like kind of uncomfortable. And I'm sure like if you go to the gym and like look at some holds, you can tell the difference between like when you look at like Jared's Samstone, it looks like a piece of Joe's is on the wall. And then if you look at like some other companies, like Rock Texture, it's like, I don't know what that is, but I don't want to grab it. And like the, like both Kilter and Pusher, I think do a really good job of making like fun, like ergonomic, and they do it differently. Like Ian has his own style, but like he does a really good job with the sandstone and the granite texture. And like he has his style and Jared has his style, and they're both like do a really good job with it. Ian is also very meticulous and like very just like Jared. It's not OCD, but it is OCD about like every detail has to be perfect. And I think that's important, because when you mold a hold and put it on your website and sell it and like give it to hundreds of thousands of people, and like it potentially is going to be something that people will climb on for the next like 100 years, and will like the boss is like was made in the 80s and is still a hold that is on people's wall and is still like, I think.
Can you describe which one that is real quick?
The boss looks like a brain. It's the old, it's like the big sloper that's this big, and it's got the font bubbles on the top, right, and then like the brain divot in the middle. And that was like the first big sloper feature. And Pusher was like the first, they were the first of a lot of things. It was like, they really did do a lot of firsts. But the boss is like maybe one of the most recognizable famous holds. Not hold's gonna be famous for, you know, it's like timeless hold. Anytime you make a hold, like everything you, all the little divots or like little birthmarks and like all these little things that you don't take care of will be there forever. The bubble wrap's another like iconic hold that will like always be around. Like there will always be bubble wrap holds and they will always be sick. Like I set a boulder with the bubble wrap holds Thursday and they're still sick. The bubble wrap looks like a pie. It's like a half moon, and it's got little tiny bubbles on the top.
Honestly,
of it.
Honestly, I hate these holds.
Really?
Sorry.
I love the bubble wrap.
It's a texture thing for me, and the fact that I'm bad at climbing, basically.
Let's I actually, so Ty shaped the bubble wrap, and it doesn't exist anymore. But he showed me one of the times I went to Waco. The first bubble wrap hold that he ever shaped. And it's cool because it has a little rock texture in it. Like when he first made it, he like added some cracks into it. But essentially I think the story goes like he was setting a bunch of comps at the time, and Chris Sharma and somebody else were competing and they were always tying. They would always either fall or they would send the roux. And he was sick of them tying. So he's like, I need to come up with something that separate them. And so he shaped the bubble wrap, which was like probably the first hold to like really make you like fumble around to get the right spot. Like when you grab a bubble wrap, you can't just like slap to it. You need to like take it right. And so he shaped the bubble wrap so that you had to like take it in the right position and grab it. Just like when you're climbing outside, you like will grab a hold and like fiddle around to get the right bubbles. And sure enough, like Chris jumped the hold and was like, and then jumped the next hold and did the root and won. And then the next guy came out and like jumped the hold and grabbed it and like tried to keep grabbing it and was like bumping around on it and then didn't do the next move. So it ended up separating them. I could keep talking about cotton poles forever.
Well, okay. I guess big one that a lot of people have been talking about more recently. How do you feel about like no-tex holds?
Oh, I love no-tex holds.
Nice.
I have a huge issue with the rules around no-tex holds. I actually have a big frustration. So they released the no-tex holds. Climbers adapted, which included spitting and licking on your hands, because when you have moist hands, you stick to the no-tex better. Then the next season rolled around and they started setting these boulders because it's a new technology. So it's like, what can we do? So they started to introduce changes of like state, right? So it's like you start on fiberglass and then you move to clear holds, or you start on clear holds and then you move to fiberglass, which are completely different states. Like for fiberglass, you need really dry skin, and for it's dual tex, you need really like tacky moist skin. So essentially, like if you like mist your hands and then let them dry for a second, that's like really the tacky feeling you want. Or like if you lick your fingers and then let them dry for a minute. But then competitors were like licking their fingers and like springing out bottles of spray and like, you know, essentially adapting to this new thing. And so the IFSC introduced rules now where like you're not allowed to lick your hands or spit on your hands, which like I get it's kind of a biohazard-ish. Yeah. And I know that some people are like, ew, that's gross, germs, illness, whatever. But like on the other hand, all of those germs and stuff still exist on the wall anyways. Like you sneezing and like wash, you know, going to the, like all of like these germs are all still just right there and you're still like climbing. Like if like, I don't know, if I were to climb on a boulder, the last thing I want to do is lick my hands after I like I've already gotten all the germs. And so like if I were someone else with a spit on their hands and then climb on a boulder before me, I don't think there's any more germs than there already was, like with like people stepping in whatever in their climbing shoe and then putting their climbing shoe on those holds. Like, I don't know what's on your, like, I'm more concerned what's on your feet than what's on the like wall.
That's true. Yeah.
I have another tangent that I'm probably won't get into, but essentially it's been really frustrating with me because I like need, I don't know, I feel like I want all of the advantage I can have. And it was really frustrating for me to like then, now dual-tex / fiberglass are kind of like, it's like, how, what is your skin? Like, what are your genetics?
Well, I mean, you can still bring a spray.
You're not allowed to spray your hands before anymore.
Oh, really?
Your hands have to be dry before you get on the boulder.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
And so, like, it's still a fair playing field technically, but it just was, like, really frustrating all season for me. Because they introduced it in like the first comp. And then sure enough, I like turn around and it's like fiberglass start and then palm pressing on like no tex. And they're like, you can't spit on your hand. I'm like, I really want to like do the palm press mantle and then spit on my hands and get them wet and then be able to stick to these clear holds.
Okay.
It just was like kind of, I don't know. I have beef with it.
But the holds like, themselves, you like?
No, the holds themselves are cool. They're a little overused, less so now, but it's just like I'm a little tired of being asked if I can hold on to a slippery jug.
Okay.
Like, I've done, it's been asked a lot now. It's like, oh, like every company now makes, and I think I want to make some dual-tex holds too. Like I have a different idea what I want to do with them. But like the slippery jug, I'm kind of tired of grabbing. It's like, can you hold on to a, can you make your hands wet before you grab this jug?
is the question. It's like, how much do you sweat?
Yeah, I didn't know that you weren't allowed to like use sprays either. I thought I saw people using those, but
you can spray your hands, but then they have to be dry before you get on the wall. And this was a change before Korea. So Brazil, they introduced you're not allowed to spit on your hands or lick your hands.
Okay.
Which I can see why if you're like on live stream, it could potentially be like, I'm sure that like Jakob Schubert licking his hand in the World Champs in Bern like went super viral and they're like, this is a media disaster. You can't do that anymore. And then I don't know if I'm the reason they'd made this rule about the spray, but I'm sure that I made the point that is probably made the rule is that like, I was like, all right, well, I'm just going to soak my hands and then pull on a fiberglass hold if I'm not doing a boulder and I know I'm not doing the boulder, my last go, soak my hands, pull on the hold, like make it so no one else can climb on it. And like,
did you do that?
Curve the field. No, but okay. I said, I was like, I talked about doing it openly in ISO. Like, it wasn't like a like, ha ha ha, this is this trick I'm going to do. I was just like, well, I'm going to do that. And everyone was like, well, you can't do that. And I'm like, tell me why I can't do that. And they're like, but it's cheating. And I'm like, then why are you allowed to spray your hands before you grab the fire, like the dual text hold? Like, you can't tell me that I can spray my hands for certain bowlers, but I can't for other bowlers. Like, if I'm allowed to spray my hands, I'm allowed to spray them as much as I want. And I should be allowed to spray them on whatever bowler I want. And it's one of those cheeky things I say, like, you know, we talked about this before the podcast where like, I'll say outlandish things just to kind of get a rise out of people.
Yeah.
And I'm also like very anti, I don't like being told what I can and cannot do unless you can tell me a good reason why and like a logical reason why. I don't like rules or laws that don't have logic behind them. If you can logistically tell me a reason why I shouldn't be doing something, then I'm happy to follow the rule. But if it's just based on feelings or if it's not a fair, like legit logical rule, I don't like it. And so that was like, I was like, okay, well, like there's no reason I can't spray my hands right before I do like some kind of friction dependent boulder, get it wet. And then the next person's bummed.
Sure.
And they're like, but it's unfair, it's treated. I'm like, I know, but it's just right now the rules allow it. And so that's why they probably changed the rules. That makes sense why that rule is that way. It's a bummer because now they have introduced these like holds that are friction dependent or non-friction dependent. And then the setters will set boulders that are like paddle dyno to paddle. Like it's like, you know, friction dependent sloper move to dual checks jug. And you're like, okay, I have to pick which one I want to be bad on. And that I don't like because I'm just frustrated that it's like you have to pick a state.
Yeah.
I want to be able to change my state mid-boulder.
I mean, I guess the reason why they wouldn't want you to just ruin the climb for everyone else is just because it looks bad in terms of sportsmanship, I guess.
No, exactly. I mean, it makes that rule make sense. And that's part of why I said it too, is I was like, there's this gaping. And I think I'm contradicting myself because I started this argument off that I was like frustrated that they made these new rules. And now I'm like, yes, I was probably part of the reason that they made these new rules because I don't know if anyone in the rules committee heard me say this or if one of the athletes told them, but I feel like I did bring up a really good point, which is why I would personally make this new rule is like someone at some point was going to do that because it was allowed. Like there was a hole in the rules and it needed to be filled, preferably before someone did that. Like I didn't do that, have no intention of doing that, but I thought of it as like, there's this giant loophole now where like I'm allowed to spray my hands with water. Why would I not? Like if I really wanted to do well, I'd just spray my hands with water right before I climbed on the part of it is like, I also just don't think it would help. Like I think if I like, I don't know, if that was what I was focused on doing, I don't think my round would, I don't know, that would probably just make the semi and then everyone would be like mad at me.
I don't think there are any climbers on the circuit right now who would do it. I mean, I remember like, I don't remember if it was like last year or the year before, but there was like a slab start that like Yannick couldn't do. And so he kind of just like gave up and then brushed it for the next person. So yeah. I don't think anyone on the circuit would kind of go that route of like trying to sabotage other people's climbs.
Yeah, no one's done it yet. But also, the sport is growing, and at some point, someone was going to do it.
Yeah, someone should do it. I think a villain would be interesting to see.
Well, I would love a good villain.
Yeah, someone who is just a terrible person and everyone can hate on.
Couldn't be me.
Okay, so thinking about the future going forward, while we are also kind of running low on time, what are your goals for 2026, climbing and non-climbing related?
I'm not quite sure yet. I'm kind of in a transition period. I want to make the team again in bouldering. I probably won't even compete in lead this year. Probably just focus on bouldering. And I have a bunch of outdoor routes that I'd like to do. But time has gotten away from me and I'm kind of out of shape for lead climbing. So I think that those goals are going to be really hard to achieve before the season's over. I have some outdoor bouldering projects that I would also like to do, but Little Cottonwood is very tumultuous in the fall. And so I also don't know if I'll have time to do those as well, because potentially by next Monday, it'll be out of season for the fall.
Wow. Okay.
Like there's like talk of it just getting snowed out and like, and we'll see. Everyone always says that. And then the fall, like we get a snowstorm in October and then nothing till like December, like 15th or something. But there's potential that the season's over like pretty soon. And I just don't have time to climb those things either. I kind of accomplished my goal of like two semis this year. So if I do make the team again, I think like the next goal for me is like a final, but it's hard.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I know. Yeah, I know we're definitely running low on time, but I definitely want to get to some of the user submitted questions. So so first one I'll get into, this was from like way back. I was going to go into it in the intro, but we veered a different direction. So we're going to ask this one now. Someone asked, did you really start climbing at two?
Yes. I don't remember exactly. I don't remember, but it was like two or three. It was before I could walk.
Jeez.
Because my dad would like put me in a harness and they would just kind of like pull me up the wall and I would just like scramble up the wall. I also apparently at 18 months crawled. My mom like went to go put my sister down and I couldn't talk. I like didn't start talking until I was like really, I don't remember how old that was, but it was like very late in life. But I could crawl and I could walk. And my mom like let me go. I would like basically communicated that I wanted to play outside. And she's like, yeah, I'm going to go put your sister down. And I could hear, I could like comprehend what she was saying. I just wasn't talking yet. And I like climbed over our 5-foot fence and walked to the park across the street.
Oh my gosh. That's terrifying.
And then my mom like heard some voices from outside the house and she like opened the front door and there was a lady with her baby. Like and was like, is this your baby? And so apparently I thought that the fire alarm caused fires. So I like went to where our fire spot was. My mom was like, if there's a fire, this is where you go. And I like went there. And then this lady like picked me up as I was like walking across the street at like 18 months in a diaper.
Jeez.
And I like pointed my way home. So yes, I started very early. I was a very, very active kid. Like I hear my mom tells these stories and I'm like, damn, that sounds terrible. I really push you through it.
You don't like remember doing that.
No, I remember climbing into my mom's closet at a very young age. And then I don't think I ever fell out, but like very similar to the closet I have here. It's like a double door closet with the little shelf at the top. And I would like climb the door and then crawl into the little shelf. And now I'm looking at it and I'm like, wow, I was really small. If I could fit in there. I just was like always on top of things. And I just have like I just have a bunch of memories of like my entire childhood getting yelled at by other parents
for being on top of things. And it was really frustrating because I knew what I was doing and I was really good at it. And my mom was like, yeah, that's just what he does. And then someone else would come over being like, you need to get down. And I'm like, you're not my mom. Leave me alone.
Okay.
Like we went to like the zoo and there was like a playground that was like, you would go inside of the playground and then climb into the side of it. And of course, like that was boring because it was made for kids. So I would like climb the outside of it. And like some mom came over and was like, that's dangerous. You need to get down. And then at my first youth world championships, we like as a team went to the park to go get like, you know, it was like team activities or whatever. And I like climbed a tree and then all the kids were like, oh my God, you're gonna get hurt. You're gonna get down. And I was like, this is the only place I should feel safe. And for some reason, I don't feel safe right now. I was like, why am I getting called out by other US team athletes on the US rock climbing? It was pretty funny. I like vividly remember getting yelled at by all the kids and then like the coaches. I think it was Meg. Meg was like, dude, you're really upsetting all the other kids. And I'm like, I know you're good, but like, you're making my job so much harder. Can you please come down?
Okay.
Like, I don't want to deal with all these teenagers that are freaking out because you're in this tree. I was like, that's fair. For you, I will get out of the tree. For these kids, I'm very upset that they don't also want to climb the tree with me.
Well, you wouldn't want to get injured before it.
Yeah, they were like, you could get hurt before the comp. And I was like, we're at a rock climbing competition. I'm sure I can climb this tree.
I feel
fine.
Okay, next one we'll go to what kept you motivated to keep trying after all the failures at nationals to lead to your eventual success?
That's a good question. I mean, one thing that like kept being a recycling like idea is that like I could never forgive myself if I like got, you know, basically if at the end of my life I was like, but what if, like, what if I kept trying and kept going, like what could I have done if I had not quit? And I think that was like, it was like, you know, like that was the big one. So I never forget myself. I like could ask myself like, what if? I like don't want to ever have that question of like, what could have happened? Like, what could I have done?
Mm-hmm.
Like I want to know like how far I've pushed myself and then be content with knowing that I've like done all that I can do to be the best that I could be. And then the other thing too is like, just really like climbing and I really love climbing. And I'm really competitive. And so like, and this may be a long tangent, but I'm just like, keep wanting to be better. And I don't feel like I've peaked. I don't feel like I'm at the end. And like, I still just want to keep going.
Yeah.
And so like competitions, I keep signing up because I just keep realizing that I want to compete. And so, and then as far as training goes, like I'm still just fired up to be good and be, I want to be one of the greats so badly.
Yeah, no, that's
and
super
so
cool.
Like it just becomes really easy for me to motivate to go to the gym and to like keep training.
And so you were still having fun even after not making the team those times, so you still wanted to keep doing it?
Yeah, there's definitely like a lot of times that I'm not having fun. Like being a professional athlete is definitely not fun all the time. It's like a lot of crap and a lot of just suffering. Like, but that's, and I say professional athlete, but that's just like being successful at anything and being really good at anything means like doing all of the crap. And like, you know, I heard this quote from another podcast that was like, the crappy thing about all of these motivational movies is like the 30-second Rocky scene or 5-second Rocky scene lasts 5 seconds. Like all of these training montages last like 5 seconds. Like you don't realize that this stuff takes like 5 years. Like, you know, like,
oh, yeah.
That 5 second training montage is really like 5 years of your life.
Yeah, true.
Like you got to do what they do in that montage for like 5 years straight and just eat crap for 5 years if you like really want to like do the thing. So like, you know, it's a lot of that, but also I love competing. And so like, and I'm still having fun competing. And so like before I signed up for nationals, like I was like, thought I was going to maybe retire, like thought I was going to maybe not do it. And then I thought about whether I wanted to go or not. And I was like, oh, I actually, like, whether the result was good or not, I was like, I do want to go because I want to go compete. And I just had continued to be training. So I was like prepared and also less and mentally in a better position because I wanted to be there before like me. And I think that's a good question too to ask is like, if money wasn't an option or it wasn't like a thought, like if you weren't like, oh, like it's going to cost this much to go to team trials. And like, if I don't go to team trials, like my sponsors aren't going to pay me this much. And like, if I, you know, like if money's not a thing and you don't have to worry about getting paid by your sponsors or paying to go to an event or making money at a competition, like, will you go to that competition?
Right.
Like if it was just free to go and you didn't have to take off work or like whatever, like, would you go? If the answer was yes, then you should like, you know, just keep doing it.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Money does really complicate things though.
It really complicates things. Not saying you shouldn't do things because of money, because like you can't afford whatever, but that's like an easy way to decide what you want to do with your life. It's like, if I money wasn't like involved in this, would I be doing that or not?
Yeah. Okay. The next one, when you started climbing, what local climbers helped you or were people that you looked up to?
Oh, that's a great question. I had a very lovely climbing community growing up.
And you said New Mexico, right?
Yeah, in New Mexico. I had a great coach, Andre, who also owned the gym. And then he also hired another really amazing coach, Ed, who like took me under his wing and like taught me a lot about like rock climbing. And I picked up a lot of like habits from him of like, he's like an insomniac, doesn't sleep. So like, that thought it was crazy back then, but now I like will frequently wake up at like 5 o'clock in the morning and go climbing. Which I'm sure is a byproduct. Like, and yeah, everyone's like, I would never be willing to do that. And I'm just like, no, it's just what you do. You just get up at 5 and go rock climbing. And that was like what he did. And was like a really great coach. Someone else I like really valued was Brendan, who's like a guy who's just climbed to the gym, was like part of the like adult homies. Like he would climb with Ed. It would have like boys' night. I like remember when I was like invited over for the first time. They're like, all right, I think you're like finally old enough and mature enough to like hang it, but it's not. And this dude Mike, who was like really amazing. But I had like a really rad crew of like adult men that all like kind of put up with me because I was really not that fun to be around as a little teenager.
What's one bit of climbing advice and life advice from that whole thing that you feel like resonates with you most to this day?
Dude, one that I think about all the time, which is crazy, is I remember like when Brendan like sat me down and was like, dude, you cannot try the boulder problem from the ground every time. And I was like, that's what? Why not? And he was like, dude, that just makes no sense. He's like, you do all of the moves first and then you try it from the ground. And I like think about that all the time and then still frequently have to tell people that who like climb way too hard for me to be like, yo, why are you like trying it from the ground every time?
Yeah.
Like, what are you thinking? And they're like, well, I want to send it. And I'm like, yeah. And you're not going to do that if you try it from the ground every time. Like, figure out how to do the puzzle and then put the puzzle together.
Okay. I do forget that one a lot, actually. Thanks for reminding me. Yeah.
It's frequent. Like, I did it today. I tried this problem from the ground like 4 times in a row, and I still had not done the second move, but I was just like, I'm going to do it from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Never did the second move.
Yeah, I get that. Then I think that is all the questions I had. Thanks for joining me again today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Are there any, like, other words of wisdom you came up with since that time that you want to get out there?
Once again, I'm going to shout out Prisher and Osun. They're both just like really great sponsors and they're like making it possible that I can keep doing what I'm doing. I'm really thankful for that.
And where can people find you if they want to see more of your stuff?
My Instagram is Hannah Smash. I think that's it. I think Instagram's kind of the best place to find me. I'm at the Bouldering Project 30 hours a week, 30, 40 hours a week. Not 40. I never actually clocked 40. I actually had a conversation with Greg the other day where he was like, dude, you work full time. Like you've got to be in here more often. Like you haven't hit your like minimum for full time in like 3 weeks.
Oh, really?
Part of it was because I was off doing comps.
Yeah. Understandable.
I don't actually work a full-time job. I work almost a full-time job. I'm like the bare minimum to be full-time. It just feels like a lot because I spent most of my life just goofing off and rock climbing. And so 30 hours of work feels a lot more than no hours of work.
Yeah. I mean, in addition to training, it is a lot of time spent in the gym.
I do work like two full-time jobs. I work like 30 hours at the Bouldering Project, and then I'm a professional athlete. And then I like to take on other things. So I'm got like three other things going on too that are taking a bunch of time.
It's a lot. I don't know how you handle it, but good luck.
Thank you.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining me, and it was another great talk.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for making it to the end of the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoyed. Otherwise, you are a super fake climber. If you're listening on a podcasting platform, I'd appreciate if you rate it 5 stars, and you can continue the discussion on the free competition climbing Discord linked in the description. Thanks again for listening.